You're listening to Faith for Normal People, the only other God-ordained podcast on the internet.
I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias. All right, everybody, it's that time of year again.
Yeah, baseball season. Go Yankees.
Boo.
Yeah? Okay,
it's fine. It's time for another year of summer school. And we have some awesome classes. We're resurrecting the Hall Pass for another year, which gets you access to all three classes. And it's a great way to support the work we do.
Our June class is Who the Wrote the Bible, taught by the one and only Aaron Higashi.
Ever wondered who really wrote the Bible? Aaron's going to take a closer look at who may have written the Pentateuch, the historical books, and some of the most well-known prophets, plus a few thoughts on the New Testament too, of course. We're not going to leave the New Testament out. But you can expect big words like anachronisms, archaeology, ideology, but don't worry, we're going to explain them. This is the Bible for normal people after all.
And if you're ready to think about biblical authorship with a little more nuance and a lot more insight, this class is for you. The live class and Q&A are happening on Thursday, June 26th from 8 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time, followed by an exclusive extra Q&A session just for the members of the Society of Normal People. To learn more and sign up or to purchase a hall pass, head to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/summerschool25.
Today on Faith for Normal People, we're talking about the connection between racism and greed with Malcolm Foley.
Malcolm is a pastor, historian, and speaker who serves as special advisor to the President for Equity and Campus Engagement at Baylor University. He co-pastors Mosaic Waco, a multicultural church in Waco, Texas, and his new book, The Anti-Greed Gospel, is the focus of our conversation today.
Don't forget to stay tuned at the end of the episode for quiet time, during which we'll reflect on what we learned during the conversation. All right, folks, let's go.
So when we ask these questions about why do some people not have access to healthy and affordable food? Why do some people not have access to housing? Why do some people not have access to these things that are necessary for human flourishing? And when we ask those questions, where it often ends up is not just in hate, but in economic self-interest.
Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
At the end of the day, I feel like this argument is very compelling, that greed is at the heart of a lot of American racism. So let's start high level. Can you explain that connection between greed and racism?
At its root, what I'm making is first a historical argument. So it's first arguing that the reason why the category of race even exists is fundamentally because of greed. So when the Portuguese get to Africa, witness chattel slavery, and decide to get involved, they don't get involved because they're racist. They get involved because they have markets they want to expand. And then as they then have to justify their involvement in that system, that's when they start to lean into this language of particularly whiteness and blackness. The blackness of Africans signifies the fact that they should be exploited and taken advantage of. It signifies that they're heathens, that they're uncivilized, all those kinds of things. But all of that is just rationalization of the fact that, well, actually, this is just an opportunity for us to make a whole bunch of profit. And as you look through, especially American history, whenever race kind of pops up as a justifying narrative, not just justifying, but also mystifying, what it's hiding is who's making money off of these states of affairs. One of the things I want to press in the book is that, you know, this. When we talk about race and racism, we're not just talking about kind of thinking wrongly. Because if that were the case, then if we just thought differently, then it would solve all of our issues.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
We're talking about deep material desires and material realities. And so if we're going to resist those systems, we've got to do so materially. We've got to think about what it means for our money, for our resources, for our for our influence, all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So that's what I want to press.
Good. Well, I think that's a great high level, but maybe let's take a step back and maybe get to know you a little bit. What's your own story around this idea? Like, do you have personal experiences or like some ahas, revelations that led you to some of the insights here? Like, what? Give us a little of your backstory here.
For a number of years, I had absolutely no desire to talk about race at all. From my master's program, people would suggest that I do some stuff with race, and I'm like, I don't just want to be another black scholar who talks about race all the time. And so I was set up to do work on the Greek Church Fathers and Calvin. It's all stuff that I deeply, deeply love and was ready to do my dissertation on it in the PhD. But then I took a class on Christianity after the Civil War, and we were talking about the fundamentalist modernist controversy in the early 20th century. But what kept going through my mind was, wait a minute, there are black men and women being set on fire across the South. What's the church doing and saying about that? And I kept looking for books and articles, and I just found essentially paragraphs on it, on what black churches were doing in response to it. So that's what then led to me writing my dissertation. But it also led to deeper questions about not just the brutality of that violence, but why did it last so long? Why did it start? Why did it continue? All of those kinds of things. And as I started to ask more of those questions, it kept coming back. It basically kept coming back to money. And then in early 2022, I reread Martin Luther King's Where Do We Go From Here? I read Jonathan Tran's Asian Americans and the Spirit of Racial Capitalism. And I read what is now one of my favorite books of theology, Antonio Gonzalez's God's Reign and the End of Empires. And when I was able to put all of that together, what it did, it gave me a language. It gave me a language for this stuff that's what I wanted to communicate with people in this book. Like, a number of those resources are not written, like, they're not written for, like, they're just not written for everybody. Like, they're written for academics and stuff. And my thing is, this is actually an understanding of the world that I think it's important for every Christian, for every person to understand that what we're up against is not just, like I said, not just these ideas, but these deep material realities that actually lead to death for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. The stakes are very, 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 very high.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to be able to articulate that.
Well, and to maybe just state the obvious, this is not a new idea.
No.
But you didn't just make this up last week and wrote a book about it, right? So could you help us understand more about when this started coming into the consciousness, let's say, of Christians in the West?
Even when you look at the history of abolition, especially with a number of black abolitionists, they're very clear about what's bad about slavery. They're very clear that it's an issue of avarice, of greed. It's clear in David Walker's work, and David Walker is my favorite American abolitionist. But he's got his book, An Appeal to the Colored Citizens of the World. And in it, he's very clear, like, the primary issue with this is greed. When you look through King's work, especially in the last few years of his life, he's very clear that when we're dealing with issues of race, we're also dealing with issues of economy. Especially in the last few years of his life, he repeats that that there are three evils: racism, militarism, and materialism. And you can't deal with one without dealing with all three. Now since that time. And there's I think a strain of American Christianity that kind of refuses to reckon with greed, especially because it just lies at the root of so much that we do. But particularly in conversations about race, there's always been this stream that has pointed to issues of greed and political economy as the root of these issues, as opposed to just, well, if we just think differently about each other, or just hang out with, each other more, then the problem will be solved. It's a stream that's been present for a while, but it's not as popular because it requires more of people.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, sometimes the greed is what funds our religious institutions, and so we don't want to necessarily mess with that. But can you give us some more specific examples where we find this connection? So you kind of mentioned it was in reading about kind of post-Civil War and all of that. But what are some connections where we find economic interests driving this like racial oppression? So we can give people some practical, put their arms around it.
So, like I said, racialized chattel slavery is the easy one. It's very clear that it continues because there are some people who make a whole bunch of money off of it. Immediately after Reconstruction, so as I said, my specialty is the lynching era. And so when people think about lynching, they just think about kind of mobs of angry white people killing black men. And while that's true, that's not the fullness of what's going on in those moments. One of the things I argue in the book is that it's a phenomenon that begins because of greed, continues because of greed, and also ends because of greed. It begins because in the period after Reconstruction, a number of white folks in the South are attempting to take power back. To essentially tell black communities, hey, your place is the place of exploitable thing. So we're going to enforce you being in that position through violence. And we're going to maintain this practice by creating a number of lies about basically black men are these bestial rapists. And so this is like this is the kind of violence that's necessary to keep them in line, so to speak. But the reason why that practice fades historically is because it becomes bad for business. Mm-hmm. It becomes an embarrassment. You get editorials coming out of places like France and Japan saying, "What are these Americans doing?" At a time when the South is industrializing and seeking northern investment, like this particular practice becomes a blight. Just becomes a blight on the South, and so it fades, and you find other ways to like disappear people and lean into Jim Crow legislation, lean into other ways of suppressing these communities that aren't as visibly violent. People start, you move the violence into the carceral system. So capital punishment increases, but you're not killing that person in front of crowds of thousands of people anymore. Mm-hmm. The violence doesn't stop. It just moves. Mm-hmm. Because it has a purpose that it has to fulfill. So people love to talk about The Color of Law. This book by Richard Rothstein talks about redlining. And the government kind of investing in the creation of segregated communities, especially in the North. But that book doesn't answer the question of why. Like, why would the government do something like that? We could just rest and say, "Oh, well, it's just because they were racist." But that doesn't actually answer the question. Kiyonga Yamada Taylor has this book called Race for Profit, and one of the things that she presses is that what's actually happening there is a public-private partnership that is ultimately meant to basically suck the wealth out of black communities. Mm-hmm. So basically policy moves from racist exclusion to predatory inclusion. And so black people are invited now after 1968 to get involved in the housing, market, but often at terms that are not amenable to them. Terms that are ultimately their exploitation. Mm. So when we ask these questions about why do some people not have access to healthy and affordable food? Why do some people not have access to housing? Why do some people not have access to these things that are necessary for human flourishing? And when we ask those questions, where it often ends up is not just in hate, but in economic self-interest. Mm-hmm. I want us to be aware of that. But then there's the secondary point, because that's all historical stuff. One of the things I want to press in this book is that I think there's a sense in which Jesus told us that this was the case in the Sermon on the Mount. So what I'm also arguing is that America's history of race and racism is actually a proxy battle of a cosmic war. And that cosmic war is between God and mammon. As Jesus says in Matthew 6:24, you can't serve two masters. You'll either love one and hate the other, or be loyal to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and mammon, which is the Aramaic word for riches. I'm deeply convinced that one of the most significant, for the Christian, the most significant battle for our souls is a battle between God and money for control. Mm-hmm. And I think that most of us have not been prepared to be found on the right side of that battle.
Schon wieder Bewerberflaute? Sie schalten Anzeige um Anzeige. Das nervt und ist doch viel zu teuer. Stopp! Raus aus der Recruiting-Spirale. Mit StepStone All Jobs bekommen Sie alle Anzeigen für ein Jahr in einem Paket zu einem fixen Preis. So sparen Sie bis zu 75% Kosten pro Bewerbung und sind jederzeit flexibel. Jetzt Termin vereinbaren auf stepstone.de/alljobs. StepStone. Einfach die richtigen Talente finden für alle Jobs.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
That's a profound point. I mean, that sort of touches every aspect of our lives. And it's such a simple concept, race and greed. But then it seems obvious the more you talk about it, but it's got such deep, it's got deep and wide, the tentacles reach very, very far. You know, slightly off topic, I'm reading Howard Zinn's People's History of America, right? And he has quote after quote of in Congress during the Civil War, it says, we can't let these slaves go. Are you kidding me? What are we going to do with our cash? How are we going to stay rich? You know, and it's amazing to see this. It's like it's explicit in our history, and we wonder why there is economic disparity even today. I mean, it's baked into the system like DNA, and there's a reason why things are the way they are.
Yeah,
yeah, and also it seems like some of the legacy of that is when you are historically disadvantaged. Then it becomes easier, again, not out of hate or necessarily race particular, but just you are exploitable as a people. You can be taken advantage of because you may be desperate to get into a house or these things. And so it sort of snowballs past race into these other things. And then, like you said, you just because you're black, it's identifiable and it's culturally acceptable. To exploit and take advantage. And so we're going to target you for that exploitation.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's exactly the way that it works. So when I see people focusing on, for example, hate and ignorance as the evils that flow out of race and racism, I'm like, the hate and ignorance is like, it's there.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But it comes downstream. When you have years of treating somebody like an exploitable thing, like, yeah, you're not going to like them because you spend all this energy essentially creating this image of them, not as a human being, but as something less than a human being, because that's what's necessary for you to continue to take advantage of them in the ways that seem to be beneficial to you in the sense that you end up making a whole bunch of money.
Well, mm-hmm. you brought in Jesus. Can we talk a little bit more about can we talk about the church a little bit? Because
I'm a big fan. Well,
the church, which is not to be confused with
not
Jesus.
Not to be confused
right,
with Jesus.
It. Okay. Right.
How has the church historically dealt with this? Like, in what ways has the church contributed or fought against this? Like, how do we implicate ourselves in this?
Yeah. You know, the most positive examples that I give in the book actually come out of the early church, and also
then it just all downhill also, from there.
Yeah, no, after Constantine, man, and we get in bed with Empire, like everything's out the window. But also the Black church in this country, just because, like, for me, it's that being in a position of being persecuted. Sets your priorities in, I think, really important ways. One of the things I tell my church is that one of the easiest ways to dilute Christian witness is to give people money, power, and cultural influence. Because it's very easy. It's just so easy to get comfortable. It's so easy to get comfortable and then find ways to then justify why you need to remain in power once you have it. Or find ways to justify why I should continue to have millions and millions of dollars because I have it. I don't want to lose it. a lot of American Christianity has been trying to find ways to prove Jesus wrong when he says you can't serve both God and mammon. They're yeah, like,
that's good.
Like, actually, Jesus, you're just not as creative as we are. Like, yeah. we can figure this out.
Yeah.
and Jesus is like, no, like it's not possible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that that has been most encouraging to me from folks like Basil of Caesarea and John Chrysostom is that there's this just fundamental assumption that at the root of the Christian ethic is an open-handedness toward the needy.
Mm-hmm.
And like that's fundamental to what it means to be a Christian. And that flows out of a Christology. So this is an argument that I'm making in chapter 5, that if we understand Christ to mm-hmm. be one who, though he was in the form of God, didn't see equality with God as a thing to be selfishly held onto, but instead took on the form of a servant, emptied himself. That's not just a picture of humility. It's also a picture of generosity. Like it's a picture of Christ as one who saw everything that he had, not as meant to be hoarded for himself, but to share with humanity, which is insane. We were preaching through the book of Revelation over the course of the past 6 months. We started like the week before the election. It's
okay.
Excellent timing. Great timing. It's been some of my favorite preaching of all time because there's an image kind of over and over again throughout the book of Revelation of the end being the saints ruling alongside Christ. Mm-hmm. And it's a picture to the point of like, so in Revelation 3:21, Jesus says, to the one who overcomes, I will give to them the right to sit with me on my throne, just as I overcame and sat with my Father on his throne. Because like the image of the saints ruling alongside Christ, people could think that it's just, well, we get like little thrones around him and he gets the big one. And Jesus is saying, no, like you sit with me on my chair, because I took on flesh to share everything that I have with you, even his very throne. If that is the picture of the Christ that we serve, one who hoards nothing for himself, but instead seeks to share all that he has with us. That's the model. That is essentially a model for the way that we ought to think about any power or resources that the Lord sees fit to give us. It's not meant for me just to amass for myself. It's meant for me to share with all those who might need it.
Mm-hmm.
This is the example that we're given in the church in Acts. Immediately after the descension of the Holy Spirit, they're marked by four things. They're marked by their devotion to the apostles' teaching, prayer, the breaking of bread, and koinonia, the fellowship. And that word fellowship or sharing, well, the question is like, well, what are they sharing? They're sharing their material goods.
Mm-hmm.
They're sharing to make sure that the people in their midst don't have any need. And then we're told in Acts 4 that God's grace was so powerfully at work in their midst that there were no needy people in their midst. Not because they kicked the needy out, but because when they saw people in need that came into this community, they're like, well, the only reason the Lord has given us stuff is in order to share it. So let's meet these needs.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most significant witnesses of the church is supposed to be its economic witness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We forget that pretty easily because we're an economic power, a lot of us. So yeah. Yeah. Can I just follow up with something?
Please.
Cause you mentioned a couple of figures from the early church and earlier you also had an interest in Calvin, and
I did. Still do.
Do you find any themes similar in the Reformed tradition that are similar to Basil and others that you mentioned?
Well, I mean, a lot of this is even present in Calvin's commentaries. When he reflects on whether it's 2 Corinthians 8 the relationship between the Corinthians and the Macedonians and all these things about especially care for the poor. I mean, this was something that, I mean, when he formed the diaconate in Geneva, there were extensive ministries to care for the refugees in Geneva because it was largely a refugee community. And kind of care for the poor was one of his most explicit pastoral priorities. And then I think about, I mean, some of my favorite Reformed figures. I mean, it's Calvin, Bovink, Alan Bozak, others who are very clear that fundamental to the Christian ethic is a care and open handedness with the needy. There are some Reformed sources of some bright spots in the Reformed tradition on these on some of these points.
Yeah, maybe more than just a juridical kind of tradition. There are maybe hearts in there too, someplace.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Sometimes you got to dig. Sometimes you got to dig a little bit, but it's there.
Is this when you were talking earlier about this generosity? Can you say more about that? And is that what you mean by economic solidarity? I feel like that's that's a kind of a $10 term that people hear.
Yes,
but it feels abstract. So the way you're talking about it feels very practical. So can you say more about that?
One of the things I want to argue, and this happens in chapter five, when people think about the opposite of greed, they generally think about generosity. But I want to complicate that because it can also be easy for generosity to turn into paternalism, where I, because I have so much and you have so little, I'm clearly superior. So let me descend to your level for a moment.
Well, it's a derivative control too, right? Yeah, it's like, let me amass it first. Then I'll give some to you so that I can still feel secure in my muchness and be generous.
And look how great I am.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And my giving to you might actually even glean significant benefit for me, mm-hmm. whether it's control over your organization mm-hmm. or whatever.
Or tax break.
Tax benefits, all those things. And that essentially ends up as paternalism. But that is not the way that, to go back to the Christological point, that's not the way that Christ gave to us. He actively became one of us, walked alongside us. That's the picture of solidarity that I'm trying to draw, is one where it brings the giver and receiver together in an understanding that, like, I may have things that you need, but there are also things that you have that I need. Mm-hmm. So this is an exchange. Equality is not just a static position. It's a relationship of exchange. It's a relationship of recognizing that in order to build true, just, and equitable community, it requires us to recognize that everybody who I'm connected with also has things that I need in order for me to grow in Christ. Mm-hmm. It's not just building kind of habits of generosity. That is habits of giving, but it's also building habits of receiving. So when people ask, like, what are two what are some applications that I want to come out of the book? The two things that first come to mind are, first, we have to build communities that are very comfortable with asking for help, which is something that's, difficult in a political economy that teaches you, it's like self-sufficiency is what you fight for tooth and nail. Like you want to be able to make it for yourself, because the only way that you do make it is by yourself. And if you succeed, it's because you worked really hard. If you fail, it's because you messed something up. So figure it out. Right. But the picture of, I think, the people who are called together by the gospel is that we are not a people who are fundamentally producers or consumers. We're people who are fundamentally sharers. But in order for us to share, we have to understand that there are things that we need. And other people might have those things. And so it's that we've got to build communities that are willing to ask for help, and communities that are willing to think about creative ways to share. Because especially in a world where we're encouraged, like I said, to hoard for ourselves and to amass for ourselves, that's also a stressful way to live, because then you've got to spend all your time protecting what you have and all that kind of stuff. When it is much more freeing to see what the Lord has given you as meant to be shared, rather than just something that you've got to protect with all of your heart and mind and soul.
So, Malcolm, help me. A thought popped into my head as you were talking, and reparations. Mm-hmm. So, how can you map that onto this issue of economic solidarity?
Sure.
Like, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is a sort of a paternalistic handout, or is it something that's more just?
Well, the best way to think about reparations is that, if someone has stolen something, the right thing to do is to return what was stolen. And when you look at especially the history, which, as I continue to argue, it's a history of economic exploitation. That is, it's a history of theft. There are a number of ways to make the reparations argument, and one is that kind of the government has done a lot of this theft, and so there's a massive debt. that the government owes. I don't think. I just personally don't think this government will ever have the moral imagination or fortitude to actually pay on that debt. But we also have church communities with significant endowments that were built on the backs of exploitative labor. We, especially those who claim to follow Christ, have responsibility to think about those resources in such a way where we're like, well, what does just redistribution look like?
Mm-hmm.
I tell my church often that I want us to think about ourselves. If we think about ourselves financially, if there's a paradigm through which we think about our church, it ought to be like we're a fundamentally redistributive body. Anything that you give to the church, like you're giving to the people, basically. And we want you to be able to see that. We want you to be able to see the ways that you're not only investing in the needy in your midst, but also in the needy in this particular community. When that's a part of your history, I think we have a responsibility to think about what is just redistribution look like.
One of the things I want to talk about, because we're talking about a lot of important ideas and thoughts, but I keep thinking you mentioned Ida B. Wells and this idea of truth telling as an important strategy here. And as I've thought about that, it just feels like learning all this stuff. Like we've learned a tremendous amount from you in the past half hour. And it's sort of like, but then I go to, everybody thinks they're truth telling. Like that's, we have an entire world online where everyone's just truth telling and truth, you know, and how do you balance then this prophetic call to speak truth to power, powerful people and powerful systems with like the self-critique, and how are we wise in our truth telling that actually brings about the changes that we hope to see?
It's why the interventions that I want to offer are threefold. So in the first few chapters, I lay out what I call the demonic cycle of self-interest, which is exploitation, violence, and lies. That we want to dominate and exploit each other because we want money and we want power, but that requires us to put people in positions that they don't want to be in. And so we use violence to keep them in that position. And then because we don't generally wake up in the morning thinking, oh, I'm really excited to dominate, exploit, and kill my neighbor, we create narratives in order to tell ourselves that that's not what we're doing to each other. So we lie to ourselves. So we've got exploitation, violence, lies. And so the second half of the book is the three interventions that fight the three elements of that cycle. So we've got communities of deep economic solidarity, creative anti-violence, and prophetic truth telling. And I don't want us to be able to break any one of those three away from the other two. So truth telling has more, it has more weight when you're already embedded in a community that is deeply committed to the love of, like, that's deeply committed to the love of neighbor in anti-violence. Like a community that's deeply committed to, you know, when we see people who are suffering from hunger or lack of housing or things like that, like these are people who reach out, who like there's not an argument, like you just reach out and figure out how do we love these folks. Similarly, a community that is deeply discomfited by inequality and one where deep economic solidarity plays itself out in a way that looks similar to the kind of impulses of the early church, where when people present needs to the community, they're like, the first thing is, how do we come together alongside this person or this family? That truth telling is never kind of a naked, like it's never just kind of a naked thing. It's something that takes place within these other community rhythms. So I think it's important. I think it's important to recognize it as a piece of a threefold cord. And the thing about each of those elements of the threefold cord, like I want to press this in the book, is that like these are not extra. These are not extra Christian things. These are just basic Christian things. Right. People aren't told that these are basic Christian things. But for me, I'm like, this is basically just straight out of the Sermon on the Mount. It's just articulated in a way that you may not have, that some folks may not have heard it said like this before, or said with the expectation, hey, like actually you ought to live in this way. This isn't just like hypothetical, like mm-hmm. maybe if you get around to it. No. Like, this is actually what the path of true joy, peace, and love is.
Have you in your community figured out a way? Because one of the things I'm thinking about is the obstacle in this community. There's a little bit of a dialectic, right? Where you need mm-hmm. you need the asking for help, but you also need mm-hmm. the sharing. And it's a little yep. chicken and the egg, and it seems very yep. scary in a yeah. community to be the one who is asking for help first when you're not sure yeah. if people are going to want to share. It yeah. seems like that's how we mm-hmm. how we meet each other's needs, are we have to be willing to redistribute labor and other things like that so that mm-hmm. my excess goes to your lack and vice versa. But if you're not sure if other people are going to be into sharing, it's really vulnerable. So how have you seen that play out in like very practical local communities?
Yeah, well, and so one of the things, so one element is, as with any of these messages, this is something that I know that the people at my church need to hear over and over and over again, because mm-hmm. some people are going to get it the first time, and then there are going to be others where it's going to take about 5 or 6 times before it actually takes root. But I also want them to be aware of the folks in their midst who are doing this well, mm-hmm. because it's happening. But if people don't know that it's happening, they can't be encouraged by it. And so one of the great things about preaching through the Sermon on the Mount, and I told the congregation this when I introduced the sermon series, I was like, I'm sure most of you are used to hearing sermons. If you hear sermons about the Sermon on the Mount, they also include a whole bunch of qualification saying like, Jesus didn't really mean this, like mm-hmm. what he really meant was this. And I'm like, I'm not doing any of that. I want us to encounter these words and then like try it. Just try like doing the things that Jesus told us to do. It's like when he says, like,
that's give crazy to talk. Everyone. That's yeah. crazy right. talk.
Right. I just like, just try it. See what happens. See what happens when you hear Jesus say, give to everyone who asks of you. Mm-hmm. And like just like try it for a week. Somebody asks you, just give it. Like what like
But
what,
I'm gonna like, have like, less stuff.
Yeah.
Don't you understand that I'm going to have less stuff if I do that? And then what? Then what will I do?
Right. I know. To which Jesus responds and says, you spend all this time worrying about what you're going to eat and what you're going to wear and all this stuff. Don't you know that your Father cares about you? Mm-hmm. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things, that is all that you need, will be added to you. Mm-hmm. I think that we read that text and we just don't believe Jesus when he says it. Mm-hmm. We're just like, that's that's nice. That sounds nice.
That's
but
great.
Like, yeah. But I really gotta, there's stuff that I've really got to shore up to make sure that I'm fine.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I'll do that eventually, but not quite yet. I need to.
Right. I got
to
build right. that exactly. 401k
we'll
up
there.
First.
We'll get there eventually.
Then, oh, gosh. I don't like this episode. It's making me think too hard about my money. I don't have any money anyway, but.
That's exactly the reaction that I want for everybody who reads this book. Like, I want everybody who reads the book to be deeply implicated by it.
Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam und die Black Friday Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem. Mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.
Achtung, es folgt eine wichtige Botschaft Ihres Mobilfunkanbieters.
Ey Mann, es gibt Leute, die drücken immer noch zu viel Knitter ab.
Nein, nicht frisch.
Lebara ist ja irgendwie smarter.
Ja, smart.
50 Gigabyte für nur 8,99.
Wenig Knete.
Ich zahle doch nicht mehr für weniger.
Nee. Das wäre auch schön blöd. Lebara, deine Knete, deine Entscheidung.
Nice.
Alle Details zu unseren Tarifen finden Sie unter lebara.de.
We're approaching the end of our time here, Malcolm, but I want to ask you, what might give you hope in this moment, or do you have any hope in this moment? Mm-hmm. And maybe what can be done to affect change?
Yeah.
Because it's we're pretty sick, I think, at this point in our country. That's my opinion, right? So what are your thoughts about that?
And I have an incredible amount of hope. And it is an unassailable kind of hope. And that's because so it would be very easy for me, I think, to place my hope in particular communities kind of doing these things right. But the thing about that is that those communities can fail. And if those communities do, the risk is that my hope goes with them. This mm-hmm. happened in Jonathan Tran's book, Asian Americans and the Spirit of Racial Capitalism. The second half of the book is specifically focused on a particular church that was living in a number of the ways that both he and I kind of frame. But in the last few years, that church has in many ways fallen apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's been reckoning with like what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, as I think of like, I will be encouraged by communities kind of doing these things. But my hope is ultimately rooted in the fact that Jesus Christ died and got up from the dead. And that he told us to live in these kinds of ways. And that he's also promised to give us the resources to be able to live in mm-hmm. these kinds of ways. And like, there's nothing, I cannot think of anything that will make me believe that less. And so even when I come up against the obstacles that I will necessarily come mm-hmm. up against, because that's the other thing that I frame here, is that like, we're not struggling against flesh and blood. We're up against powers and principalities. So the expectation is that there's going to be resistance. Like, the expectation is that it's going to be hard to kind of pry people's fingers from their goods. The expectation is that it's going to be hard to pry the claws of mammon out of the hearts and minds of the people of God. But that's what I got to do. And my hope is in the fact that it is not only work that Christ has begun, but it's work that he's promised to finish.
Mm-hmm.
And so even if I die in the process, it's not up to me to complete, but I've been able to see these wonderful glimpses of what this can look like when the people of God really commit to it. And that continues to be encouraging to me.
Oh. Well, thank you so much for this education. I think it was a fantastic conversation. So mm-hmm. thanks so much. And thanks for the hope at the end. I think that's a great benediction for us as we close. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much. Yeah,
thank you all so much for having me.
Now for Quiet Time
with Pete and Jared. This is one of these episodes, Jared. I wish we could have just done 2 hours.
Oh, I know. We could have talked for so. I mean, but part of it is
lots to learn here.
I feel like what we need is an intermission. Like, this was a great one for an intermission where it's like, hold on, let me process everything that you're saying.
Hold on a minute.
A couple of minutes. I'm gonna have some questions. I don't have questions right now, but I will have a lot of questions. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe why don't we use this for this quiet time? Why don't we use this framework that he helpfully described mm-hmm. around the cycle of exploitation, violence, and lies?
Right.
Because I think within that, a lot of concepts come out.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, this idea of exploitation is, I would just say from the beginning, for me personally, this cycle made sense. Like, I found ways of like trying to break it down into simple. It's easy to dismiss these things when we think of extreme examples like exploitation. Right. It's like, well, I'm personally not, exploiting black people in this mm-hmm. way.
Right.
And so I'm not, and violence is such a, mm-hmm. It's such a big word.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, I'm not doing violence, but I see these like immediately when you start talking, I think of little things
mm-hmm.
where it's like, oh, if I can get a better deal on this thing. Mm-hmm. But it requires me to take advantage and not be totally honest. I'm not lying, but I'm not giving you all the facts either,
right,
because
right.
then that gives me this upper hand.
Mm-hmm.
That is doing violence
mm-hmm.
because it's not treating someone as an equal. It's not treating them the way you want to be treated. It's not, as Kant says, treating someone as an end in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but I don't want to see myself as a violent person or someone who takes advantage of people.
So
I lie to myself.
Tell ourselves stories.
And right? then the more I do that, yeah. the easier it gets to exploit the next time.
Right.
And I don't know, did you resonate with
oh,
that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the lies we tell ourselves, and then the response to that is that prophetic
yeah.
calling out.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I think we invest a lot in our lives. It's a way for us to, I say us, not them. It's a way for us to maintain a sense of self we can live with, we can tolerate, and we don't like people poking at that, you know. Yeah. And the exploitation of the economic solidarity.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Which is the response?
That's like the antidote to exploitation.
That's systemic, right? So it's the answer to that. I like what he said. The answer to that is not like paternalistic charity.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the answer. That's a Band-Aid at best.
Yeah.
Now, people who don't have much would probably like to have something so they can buy food, right? I mean, I understand that, but that's not the answer. Mm-hmm. That's almost a way of ensuring that system and that cycle.
Right. In some ways, right? It's that release valve that actually perpetuates the system.
Right. It allows it to keep going without blowing up.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue of economic solidarity is one that is deeply threatening because it hits us in our pocketbook.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of the church as a redistributive body was like, man, you know.
Not at all.
I know. It's tough.
I know.
And then, yeah, there's just implications of that, right? I think I'm so programmed as an American to be like anti-communist.
Mm-hmm, right.
It's like my initial thought of like redistributive, but hold on. And it's like, wait a minute. Why is that my reaction? Mm-hmm. Like, because again, in theory, I'm all for that. Mm-hmm. But then I think Malcolm had just such a good way of making it so practical that I couldn't help but think of my own situation. Mm-hmm. And then that he did his own little prophetic truth telling without knowing it, I think, for both of us. So.
I mean, I didn't exactly squirm at times, but I did think I do this all the time where I'm not even conscious of this. And I'm so worried about, you know, retirement, for example.
Well,
right?
can we, let's just, because we're going to get into this.
Yeah.
Let's just say as a moment of vulnerability, I think I can speak for you. We both have issues with fear around money.
Yeah.
So then it's like, that's, I think, an important piece of context for both of our oh crap moments,
right?
Of like, but it's more just for my own.
I've been working so hard to not have that fear.
Yeah, right.
By getting more.
Exactly.
Which is never enough.
Yeah. Well, and I think,
and just for the record, we're not rich. Okay. No.
What's hard for me is, for me, I see it as, you know, our family didn't have a lot of money growing up. So there's this little kid in me.
Right.
It's like the little kid in me that I'm trying to protect, which doesn't feel exploited. It feels like I'm doing the right thing for me to protect that little boy who felt like maybe we weren't going to have enough.
Right.
And it's like, but in that kind of protection, you may be doing harm to other people.
And now you're protecting your family.
Yeah. Right.
And the family you don't even have yet.
Right.
Down the road, right?
Yeah.
Generations. And that's, I think, we've been programmed to think that way. And that's always been the way of the wealthy throughout history.
Yeah.
You know, even the pharaohs would be buried with their stuff, right?
But that's why I asked about that, you know, the chicken or the egg, because the challenge is when you're in a system that needs you to do that, right? We don't live in a system. We don't live in a community-based system now. So you are taking a risk.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're being generous and not saving up for retirement, let's say, like, that's a risky proposition.
Yeah.
And I think, not to speak for Malcolm, but I think what he would say is, yes, following Jesus is a risky proposition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I'm like, oh, that makes me uncomfortable. And you're right.
Right. Well, and that leads to a certain conclusion, which I don't mind saying rather brashly, but you can easily make the argument that the American economic system, and therefore the economic, the American experiment, is deeply counter to the impulse of the Christian faith.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. And you can make it as Christian as you want to. You can say we're a Christian nation because, you know, pilgrims came over and killed a lot of people and took their land, you know, so this is a Christian nation. And you know, we're the new Canaan, and you know,
we the took city over on a hill,
and God favors us, and all this kind of crap. You know, that's the lie we tell ourselves nationally.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you try to bring this up, even in an exploratory sense, with people, and people react viscerally.
Yeah.
And you get called all sorts of names. And I think that's why that kind of like the debate is not going to do it. It's not a matter of like, you don't understand something.
Right.
It's a matter of you have a deep emotional investment in something that makes meaning for your existence.
Correct.
That's the problem. And when, I'm going to sound preachy here, I don't mean to, but if that meaning for your existence is something material, it's really not Christian.
Right.
It's just not. You know, now I'm working on that myself.
Right.
You know, I'm not preaching to anybody. I'm working on that myself. But it's like, and it's just, it seems so, it's right there in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that we're too dumb to see it.
No.
Yeah. I remember Claire Davis, one of our church's professors, he would say that, you know, people say, well, you know, the reason we mistreat people, we don't really know enough. Right. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, that's nonsense. We know all sorts of things, but we still do it. Like, why do we do this? And Malcolm was saying something very, very similar. Why do we do this? Because there's something we don't want to lose.
Right.
What is it?
And not only that, but I appreciate what you're saying, which makes it even harder, which is, it reminds me of what Malcolm said about Matthew 6. Like, you can't serve God and mammon.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, it is the driving force and the map we follow, like it is the water we swim in.
Right.
And so it's like, oh, that it cuts so deep, not just in terms of our material reality, but it does kind of frame how we think of ourselves.
And we're stuck
it's our
in
identity.
It. We're stuck in it. We can't get out of it. It is the mark of the beast in a sense. You know, you can't buy or sell.
Right.
And, you know, debates in Congress go very, climate change, it goes down to, but economically it's going to hurt the working people.
Yep.
And the thing, it might.
Yeah.
And that's the conundrum we're in.
Correct.
We've built this system
that
can't be just.
Yeah.
By its very definition.
And to dismantle it will cause harm too.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
Well,
you try to get what's yours.
Yeah, exactly.
And just forget about everybody else.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly what the politicians are doing.
Man, so that's great. We ended the episode with Malcolm and giving us this great benediction of hope, and we've just dashed it in the quiet time and ended on a low note.
So the end to this is, now go back and listen to the end.
We should splice this in before we get to that last part.
Yeah, I think Malcolm has the hope because he's intimately connected with this whole concept he's thought about.
Yeah, more. Yeah.
And us is like...
Right. It feels so daunting.
Yeah, it feels...
Overwhelming.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Yeah. Have a good day.
Well, thanks to everyone who supports the show. If you want to support what we do, there are three ways you can do it. One, if you just want to give a little money, go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/give.
And if you want to support us and want an all-access pass to our classes, ad-free live stream of the podcast, and a thoughtful community of people asking tough questions about the Bible and faith, you can become a member of our online community, the Society of Normal People, at thebiblefornormalpeople.com/join.
And lastly, it goes a long way if you just wanted to rate the podcast, leave a review, and tell others about our show. In addition, you can let us know what you thought about the episode by emailing us at info@thebiblefornormalpeople.com.
You've just made it through another episode of Faith for Normal People. Don't forget you can catch our other show, The Bible for Normal People, in the same feed wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was brought to you by the Bible for Normal People team. Brittany Hodge, Joel Limbowen, Melissa Yando, Tessa Stoltz, Danny Wong, Lauren O'Connell, and Naomi Gonzalez.
Well, hopefully... All right. Here we go.